I don't know if things are going to get crazy again like they did with Angus Oak, but if they do, we need a way to communicate alibis successfully over the phone. You can't just send your lawyer over every time you need to work something out. You might not always have time. The cops might get to me before he does. I might be out of town when you need me. And that whole business was so messy, so much could have gone wrong. So we should plan ahead and be prepared, you know, like the Boy Scouts.
Fuck the Boy Scouts, I'd said. Be prepared was my motto before there were any streets to help little old ladies across.
Oh, right.
Granuelle had paused, and when I failed to fill the silence, she asked,
Does that mean you already have a plan, Sensei?
No, I'm just establishing my primacy over the Boy Scouts. Granuelle's lips quirked upward.
Duly noted. I have a plan, Sensei, if you'd like to hear it.
Of course I would. Thinking ahead like this is why you'll make a good druid. Seriously, I added, because we were still too unfamiliar with each other for her to see through my customary curtain of wit.
Thank you.
Her cheeks had colored faintly at the praise.
Well, you have to assume these days that all your cell phone calls are being listened to, and maybe your home and business phones, too. That means you have to say what you mean in code. But if the code is too obscure or in a foreign language, they'll flag your ass for suspicious activity and put you on the no-fly list.
Beg your pardon? I interrupted. Who are they?
The government, the cops, the men in black, maybe even the Boy Scouts. Them.
Ah. Please continue.
So, we need a simple code, and I was thinking that since we've already pretended that we're romantically involved in one alibi, we should stick with that concept in future situations.
We should, eh? The beginnings of a smile played at the corners of my mouth.
Just pretending, she'd emphasized, her cheeks flushing more hotly. Then we can call each other as necessary, throw out a code phrase, and then lay the alibi down.
What's the code phrase?
Oh, well, it's a question in keeping with the pretense of our relationship. It's, can I tell you one of the many reasons I love you? And then the other person says, sure. And then you just explain what we did last night and where and so on, putting in something cute or lovey-dovey for a verisimilitude, and bam! You've slipped an alibi right past the ears of the military-industrial-authoritarian douche-canoe complex.
I raised my eyebrows and nodded appreciatively. Hey, that's not bad, I told her. It's even a turn-off to eavesdroppers when you get all sickeningly sweet with your voice. Listening to other people be ooey-gooey with each other is a guaranteed recipe for nausea. So let's call it a plan and hope we never have to use it. Now that we had to use it, only a week after she'd brilliantly made the suggestion, Granuelle picked it up with only the slightest of pauses.
Sure you can, Atticus,
she said, her voice turning syrupy.
Anytime you want to tell me why you love me, I'm all ears, baby.
Well, you know how last night we went out to that park north of Indian Bend Road that has the lights on all night, and we hit baseballs for Oberon to chase? I just thought it was special how you picked up the baseballs all covered in drool and bite marks when I know you hate that kind of thing.
Well, Oberon's sweet,
Granuelle replied.
We were out there a long time. How many balls do you think we hit?
I was so proud I could have popped. Such a clever mind. We had a dozen, I replied. And don't forget, those two bats are still in the trunk of your car.
Oh, they are? I don't remember. Are those yours, or do I need to return them to someone?
So quick. She knew precisely what to ask. When I'd first agreed to make her my apprentice, it was partially under duress, but now I could see that I was wildly fortunate. Those are mine. The wooden ones are mine, the Wilsons. The aluminum bats were the borrowed ones. I've already returned them.
Oh, is that all?
That's it. The balls and bats are in your trunk, and you're my snooky-wooky marshmallow fudge love pie.
Wait. Did you just call me a Wookie?
I chuckled. Caught that, did ya? I ended my conversation with her, and then made my last call from my home phone. I'd saved it for last because I knew I'd be getting scolded. Lambasted. Reamed, even, in a Polish accent.
That was poorly handled last night, Mr. O'Sullivan,
Melina said immediately. Those kind of opponents aren't my specialty, I replied, wary of using the word bakant on a phone, untapped or not. And I got most of them.
What do you mean, most of them?
There were 15, not 12, as your divination foretold, so that was poorly handled, Miss Sokowovsky. Talking about divination and spells on the phone never worried me. Anyone listening from the government would dismiss us as fruity New Age hippies.
How many got away? Melina asked.
Just one.
She will return to Las Vegas then, but she may bring more next time.
Well, I can't help next time. If that last one had wanted to fight, I'm not sure I could have taken her. What news of the Hexen?
We have managed to bid farewell to two of them.
From your condo?
Even so.
She sounded a bit smug. You knew them previously?
No, these were younger members, not so well protected and not so wise about masking their true nature.
That told me that Melina didn't necessarily need hair or blood to deliver a lethal attack from afar. And she knew how to pick magic users out of a crowd. Good to know. Well done, I said. Does that mean you know where the rest of them are?
Unfortunately not. We are getting closer, however. We've narrowed it down to Gilbert, but we need more bloodwort.
All right, I'll send over a courier with 3 more pounds. No one's going to be asking about the two you bid farewell to, are they?
You mean the way people are asking about what you did last night? No, there was nothing suspicious in their leave-taking.
Oh, I see. Accidents happen.
You should try subtlety sometime. But look, they're going to know they didn't succeed in getting us their first time around, so you should prepare for more attacks, however it is that you do that.
Attacks like the first one?
No, I imagine they'll try something different. It probably won't be as flashy, but the result will leave you just as dead, if you're not protected.
Okay. Thanks for the warning. A car screeched to a halt outside.
Your werewolf lawyer's here,
Oberon said.
Betcha he smells like citrus air freshener.
I bet it's vanilla. I quickly said farewell to Melina and opened the front door to see Hal stalking up my front steps, a scowl on his face and a newspaper in his hand. Good afternoon, sir. My, what impeccable tailoring you have. Hal stopped in his tracks and eyed me warily. What the hell happened to you? He said, taking in my shirtless and heavily bruised and scratched form. He gestured at my wounds and asked, Is that from last night? No, it's from the rough sex this morning. Smartass. Sorry I asked. Hey, did you get your ear back? Yep, that was definitely the best part of my day so far. Hal sighed in relief and waved the newspaper significantly. I'll say, you lucky bastard. Police are looking for a guy that matches your description with a missing right ear. I thought they had your number on that one. I threw up my hands, perplexed. How do police even know what to look for? The only two cops who saw me got killed. Well, some of the modern-day fops fleeing the club saw you handcuffed on the ground in custody of the now-deceased police, so naturally the living police are anxious to figure out what happened to said suspect. They have your clothes and hair color, along with the missing ear to go on, and that's it. No descriptions of your face, since you were sucking asphalt.
Any mention of my tattoos?
Happily not. Your tats must have been face down because of the way they had you cuffed, so they're searching for a tatless, earless guy.
Hal sniffed the air speculatively and frowned.
Is something burning?
My house was for a while, but not anymore.
Oh, he said, and the fires of his curiosity were extinguished just like that. Well, it's kind of irritating even out here, so would you mind if we sat on the porch?
Not at all. I gestured to a chair, and Hal handed me the newspaper as he took it. Oberon thumped his tail against the chair and pushed his head under Hal's hand.
"Hey, Pooch,"
Hal said, obligingly giving Oberon's head a scratch.
"I win. He smells like citrus on top of wet dog."
"Did it ever occur to you that maybe he's trying to mask the wet dog smell with the citrus?"
"That doesn't make any sense, Atticus. Wet dog is a perfectly acceptable way for a werewolf to smell. I think it must be the other way around."
"Saturn Massacre," the newspaper screamed at me. 25 dead, including 2 officers in nightclub nightmare. The photos showed body bags lined up outside the club. Scottsdale. Police are still searching for suspects in the aftermath of the city's worst mass murder, which occurred last night in the Saturn nightclub on Scottsdale Road. Witnesses were unsure exactly how the killings began, but the deaths of 2 Scottsdale police officers ended the carnage. I scanned the rest of the article quickly. "Huh. They mention the broken bats, but they don't mention my sword in here," I said.
"You were whipping your sword around in front of all those witnesses?"
"No, no," I said. I explained what happened last night and the alibi I had cooked up with Grognewail via lovey-dovey code. "I still have my receipt from Target," I pointed out, "and chances are good they'll find that security tape anyway, if they're any good at their jobs. So we'll just say Grognewail's bats are my bats, slightly scuffed and used from a night of baseball chasing with the dog."
"This means I need to chew on some baseballs, doesn't it?"
"Yes, it does. But if you're nice about it, I'll put some gravy on them first."
"Prints on the bats?"
Hal asked. "Took care of it."
"So, you couldn't possibly be their man from the club because you have an ear and you still have your bats intact."
"I see." Hal nodded.
"That might confuse things quite a bit if it were to come to trial, especially since the missing ear detail is being so widely reported. There's your reasonable doubt right there. But you're still in a heap of trouble if any of those witnesses reported seeing the sword. You've been riding around with that thing on your back the past few weeks. Everyone up and down Mill Avenue has seen you wearing it, and they might have noticed you didn't have an ear either."
"So what? The sword never left its scabbard. Nobody died from sword wounds."
"They'll use the sword to place you at the scene, Atticus. Look, do you still have it around here?"
"Of course. I have 2 fancy-schmancy swords now." The other one had belonged to Angus Og. His sword was named Moralta, the Great Fury, and it had fallen to me by right of besting him in a duel.
"I suggest you hide both of them right now, and hide them well. Don't lose a minute."
"What? Why?"
"I think Tempe's going to be working with Scottsdale on this to make sure they do things right, because of how royally they screwed up in your shop,"
Hal said, alluding to a search warrant gone fantastically wrong that ended up with a Tempe police detective and me getting shot.
"Which means they're going to roll up here with a full search warrant for your place. They'll do it all by the book, and if they find a sword, they're going to take you downtown for a long talk."
"What about bows and arrows and other martial arts stuff like sai and throwing knives and such?"
"Why? Do you have any of that floating around?"
"The garage is full of it." Hal cursed in Old Norse for a moment, then switched back to English.
"Damn it, Atticus, you need to get yourself a bat cave or something for all of your shady shit."
"Why? I thought it was all legal."
"It is, but in situations like this, you don't want them to smell smoke and figure there's been a fire. Which turns out to be literally true in this case."
He sniffed and wrinkled his nose.
"What started the fire, anyway?"
"A visiting goddess."
"Are you being serious or pulling my hair?"
"Completely serious." I didn't tell him the correct expression was pulling my leg because he was doing so well otherwise. Hal was quite a bit younger than Leaf and more willing to make an effort to use American vernacular correctly. He usually appreciated it when I corrected him, but I didn't want to distract him now.
"Anything I should be worried about?"
"Nah, it's all Irish politics." Hal looked at me sharply and shook a finger in my face.
That's bloody dangerous, getting involved in that. You be careful.
I gaped at Hal. I can't believe you just said that to me.
Yeah, because, like, you're always careful. Fetishistically so.
What? Hal protested, shrugging his shoulders and looking aggrieved. I called to ask Gunnar for help with the Bakkens yesterday, and he shut me down. No well-wishing, no pleas to be careful, nothing. So now we're dealing with the aftermath of what happens when I try to go it alone, and you tell me to be careful about Irish politics?
Can I have a treat for using fetishistically in a sentence?
Well, I know precisely where Gunnar's coming from. It's not our job to keep the magical peace. Neither is it mine.
It's really hard to pronounce. If you're not careful, you could wind up saying fetish shit stick alley. And then you feel like a puppy who forgot to lift his leg, you know?
Well then, why did you get involved? Hal asked.
I thought about explaining that I needed a safe place to live and work so I could restore the land around Tony Cabin, but it seemed too arcane, and he might not understand why I was so eager to tackle a project that would take years to finish. I shrugged instead and said,
Irish politics. There you go. Bloody dangerous. Our job is to keep you out of jail when you get in trouble, not help you get into trouble in the first place. Come on.
He rose from his chair and gestured inside.
I'll help you get everything stowed.
I think Hal should get a treat, too, if he keeps you out of jail,
Oberon said as we walked inside. You don't offer werewolves treats if you want to keep all your appendages. They think it's undignified and degrading to be offered a treat.
Well, the moon must have addled their brains when they were thinking that one through, because I don't see a downside to treats. Honestly, Atticus, it's like they have no regard for the canine code.
I beg your pardon?
The code. Has anyone taken the time to explain to them that treats are, by definition, a savory snack of succulents, appropriate at any time and for any occasion, with the possible exception of funerals?
No. You just made all of that up.
Precisely. I'm such a creative hound that I deserve a treat.
Clearly. I stopped in the kitchen to grab a handful of treats for Oberon out of the slightly scorched pantry cabinet. After you finish these, I want you to stand sentinel on the front porch, and let me know if anyone drives up, please.
Okay. Man, these are gravy. Werewolves don't know what they're missing.
I collected moral tar from the garage, a couple of other practice swords, and a roll of oilskin. The real stuff, not the synthetic fabric they call oilskin these days, because I'm a natural fiber kind of guy. Since I didn't have a bat cave, I'd have to hide everything by using magic. I got out some scissors and started cutting lengths of oilskin, then told Hal to wrap the swords in them so that every inch was covered.
Do you have some duct tape or something to keep it all together?
I stopped slicing through oilskin and looked up at my lawyer. Hal? I'm a druid. Like, for reals. Hal flushed and muttered an apology.
Right, you can bind it yourself, can't you?
Yes, I can. Are you ready with that one?
Right, yes.
Hold the edges down, then, I said and waited for Hal to do it. Dune, I said in Irish. The fibers from the edges threaded themselves into the weave of the full canvas, creating a sort of Mobius strip where the fabric had no beginning or end, save where I could see it. To Hal's eye, it looked as if the edge had just disappeared and smoothed out, an unbroken piece of fabric. Hal shook his head.
Too bad you don't celebrate Christmas. Your presents would look awesome.
We repeated the process three more times, and then I gathered all the swords and moved out to the backyard. Hal followed, his nostrils flaring at all the herbs I had growing back there.
You're not growing anything that looks remotely like marijuana, are you?
I snorted. Only an idiot would think so.
Cops can be idiots sometimes.
There's nothing precious here. They can confiscate it all if they feel they have to protect the public from my herb garden.
Right. So, where are we hiding them?
Hal was looking down at likely spots for burial.
and that was the wrong direction.
See my neighbor's Palo Verde tree overhanging my yard? We're going to hide them up there.
Okay. How?
The trunk was on the other side of a very tall wooden fence, and the fence wasn't the sort I could climb easily to access the branches high above.
You use your giant, hairy werewolf muscles to throw me up into the branches, and then toss me the swords. I'll bind them to the tree branches first so they won't move, then camouflage them. Those branches look pretty spindly. Sure they'll bear your weight?
Absolutely. This tree loves me.
Its roots go underneath the fence, and we talk sometimes about particulates and nitrogen and the horror of borer beetles.
Hal looked at me uncertainly.
Plus, I can temporarily strengthen the wood. Ah, okay then. I'll just put my jacket over here.
It was finished in less than 5 minutes, and Hal didn't even break a sweat chucking me up into the canopy. He usually dressed to conceal his muscular frame, because in courtrooms, muscles are associated with defendants rather than lawyers. Still, he was an imposing physical presence, a manly man, with a cleft chin and a broad smile. He wore a pair of spectacles as an affectation, for he wasn't visually impaired. He thought they made him look more gentle and intelligent to juries.
"That's a pretty good spell," Hal said,
squinting up at the branches where I had camouflaged the swords.
"I know they're there, but I can't see them."
"They'll stay camouflaged as long as I have access to a bit of power. The bindings will stay until I release them."
"Excellent. So, what do we do with the rest of your instruments of death?"
"How much time do you think we have?" Hal shrugged.
"Maybe 2 hours, maybe 2 minutes."
"Atticus, three cars are coming down the street full of guys dressed like the man."
"Thanks, Oberon. Come on into the backyard."
"More like 2 seconds," I told Hal. "They're out front right now." "Guess we'll have to wing it."
"Sure," I shrugged. "It'll probably be fun."
"Put a shirt on, will you? They're looking for someone who killed a lot of people last night, and it looks like you might have done it."
"Oh, yeah." I looked down at my torso, still messed up from the Morrigan. I'd be able to heal it pretty quickly if people would leave me in peace, but that was in short supply today.
"And don't answer a single question without me right there to harass them every step of the way."
"Got it." As we returned inside, Hal to answer the door and I to put on a shirt, I gave Oberon his instructions. "You'd better just hang out in the back while we deal with this," I told him. "Pretend you're ultra-docile and stupid. If anyone addresses you, wag your tail weakly, but don't move."
"Do I have to let the man pet me?"
"Well, you can shy away from his touch, but definitely don't bark or growl or bite anybody." Struck by inspiration, as I rifled through my shirt drawer, I pulled out an old anime shirt with lots of pointy noses, large eyes, and giant swords on it. Put it on, an instant nerd. Lots of men with suits were in my living room when I emerged from my bedroom. None of them had ever seen me before or knew what I was like, so I could play a part and get away with it.
"Dude, what the hell? Who are you guys?" I said, automatically lowering my IQ to everyone assembled.
"Atticus, these are the police,"
Hal said.
"Atticus O'Sullivan?"
A tall, sandy-haired man in a green shirt and silk tie stepped forward with his ID out.
"I'm Detective Kyle Gifford with the Tempe Police. We have a warrant to search your house for any swords you may have, as well as any blunt weapons such as baseball bats."
His name rang a bell, but I couldn't remember where I'd heard it before.
"Oh, cool," I said.
"I hope you find my sword, because I've been looking for it."
"You lost your sword?"
"I guess so, dude," I shrugged. "I don't know where it is."
"So you admit that you own a sword?"
"Well, yeah, if I could find it. I'm training to become a ninja."
The detective blinked and looked over at Hal to see if I was pulling his leg. Hal was completely stone-faced, even nodding slightly in agreement with my story.
"How long have you been missing your sword?"
Well, I think I lost it last night. Interesting. I see you have both your ears,
Gifford observed. I flicked my eyes uncertainly between him and Hal.
Thanks. And so do you? We've had reports of a man who's missing his right ear riding around Tempe with a sword.
Really? Whoa. Guess that dude should have been more careful with his sword, eh?
I chuckled a few times at my own lame joke, but looked down meekly when no one laughed.
Sorry. Nobody ever thinks I'm funny.
Suited men were looking underneath furniture and behind picture frames to see if any swords were concealed there. One of them reported that he'd found a large assortment of edged and blunt weapons in my garage.
Any swords? Gifford asked.
Not yet, just knives.
Keep me posted.
He turned back to me and asked, Mr. O'Sullivan, would you mind telling me where you were last night?
You don't have to answer that,
Hal interjected. Nah, it's okay, I told Hal, and then I said to Gifford,
I was chillaxing with my girl and my pooch. We were hitting baseballs in the park, and I took my sword off so I could swing away, you know? But damn if some douche didn't come by and jack it when I wasn't looking. I was going apeshit, dude, and I'm still pissed. If I ever catch who did it, he'll have to deal with my kung fu.
I thought you said you lost your sword. Now you say someone stole it.
I might be remembering it wrong. I do that sometimes. I lose time when I'm in a ninja trance, and I don't recall doing things. The detective's mouth opened a bit, and he stared at me as if I were a talking slime mold. I looked down and shuffled my feet a bit.
Or maybe it was all those drugs I did when I was younger. Sometimes I black out.
Gifford nodded slowly and looked at Hal. Then his eyes abruptly narrowed, and he asked,
Mr. O'Sullivan, what do you do for a living?
Ninja training.
That's your source of income?
Oh, no, I own a bookstore.
This guy had to know who I was already. Since Hal and I were suing the Tempe Police Department for shooting me last month, an unpleasant episode that was entirely Angus Oak's fault, there was no way they got a warrant to come in here without very carefully reviewing everything they had on me.
Would you say your bookstore is a successful enterprise?
I ignored him and let my eyes lose focus at a point over his right shoulder.
Mr. O'Sullivan?
Huh? What, dude? I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Gifford spoke slowly to make sure I understood.
Do you make a lot of money at your bookstore?
Oh, you're talking about Benjamin's. Yeah, dude, I have plenty.
Enough to pay for very expensive lawyers?
Well, duh, I said, pointing at Hal. He's standing here, isn't he?
Why does a bookstore owner need lawyers like Magnuson and Hawk?
Because Tempe cops keep shooting me for no reason and searching my house for shit I don't have, and then they act all surprised when I actually have both my ears. That made the detective clench his jaw for a moment, but to his credit, he didn't respond. He served up another question instead.
You mentioned playing baseball with your pooch. Would this be an Irish wolfhound?
Yes, but it's not my old one. He's still lost or run away or whatever. This is a new one. Just got him a couple of weeks ago. He's all registered and got his shots and everything. I had done precisely that to sell the fiction that my old dog was really a new dog. Again, thanks to Angus Ogue, Oberon was wanted for a crime that should have been laid at Angus's door. Luckily, it's far easier to get a new ID for a dog than it is for a person. Bureaucrats at Animal Control don't suspect people of getting fake IDs for their pets. They take your form and your check and give you a shiny set of tags for the collar, and that's it.
Where is he? Gifford
asked. In the backyard.
May I see him?
Sure, whatever, dude.
I waved at the back door, and Gifford walked through it to see this new dog of mine.
The man is coming. Remember, you're a meek little guy, turbo tame.
I see him. Looks like he sells trucks. I already don't trust him. Well, I'm going to give an Oscar-winning performance of Meek.
I peered out the kitchen window to see Gefford approaching Oberon, and my hound was as good as his word. His tail twitched hopefully on the ground. He ducked his head, and then he turned over on his back, presenting his belly and neck with his front paws hanging limply near his chest. This couldn't possibly be the man-eating animal the police were looking for in connection with the park ranger's death.
Wow, what a performance! Where did you learn to do that?
Oberon usually squirmed around during his belly rubs, and he sometimes closed his mouth gently over my arm. He never stayed that still and passive, believing as he did that belly rubs should be an interactive experience.
This is what all the tiny dogs do at the park when they see me coming.
Gefford didn't rub Oberon's belly at all. He just squatted down to check the tags on his collar to confirm that they were recent. He stood back up and looked speculatively around the yard.
Guess the man is a cat person. We should play a prank on him.
Gefford started pacing around the herb garden, looking closely at the ground to see if any of it was recently disturbed. Like what? I don't know if I can top your Oscar-winning performance.
I'm sure you'll think of something.
Hal stepped up next to me with an update on the search.
They're being much more polite this time, putting everything back once they move it. He hasn't mentioned removing you anywhere for questioning yet, so I don't think he will unless they find a sword.
I heard a clatter coming from the living room and went to investigate. A female detective had managed to spill my DVD collection all over the floor. It seemed like an excellent opportunity to burnish my character as a pathetic guy forever trapped in an adolescent fantasy land.
"Oh," I said, widening my eyes and then shifting them guiltily, shoving my hands into my pockets. "If you find any porn in there, it isn't mine."
The look she gave me was three parts disgust and two parts revulsion.
"I swear."
I edged away and carefully didn't smile until I was back in the kitchen. Hal chuckled quietly.
"You are so full of shit," he whispered.
"Hey, the care and feeding of an alter ego is an art form," I replied in the same low tone. "Here comes the detective. Watch him ask about the scorch marks." Gefford strode through the door with a frustrated frown and seemed to notice the blackened portions of my cabinetry for the first time.
"What happened to your kitchen, Mr. O'Sullivan?"
"Oh, that," I rolled my eyes. "You know those little cooking torches you used to set your creme brulee on fire? Well, I was using one of those last night on my tasty dessert and banging my head to some old-school hair bands, you know? And the torch was still on as I was doing all these fist pumps and stuff, and I didn't realize it."
Gefford scoffed openly.
"You unknowingly caused all this damage with a miniature acetylene torch?"
"Well, when you're rocking out with the crew, it's like a religious experience, dude. I had my eyes closed. Haven't you ever communed with the sound gods like that before, where you can feel the shredding in your bones?"
Gefford just shook his head and flipped open a notebook. He wanted Granuel's name and address to confirm my alibi for last night. I told him she'd have the bats in her car, but neglected to tell him that he could find her at my shop right then. Another detective walked up and said they hadn't found a sword anywhere, yet, and the blunt weapons in the garage were covered in dust and showed no signs of recent use. They shuffled everything around for another hour, but found nothing that would implicate me in last night's Saturn massacre. I spent the time outside, watering my herbs and giving Oberon a proper belly rub, while Hal kept a wary eye on them. I also sank my toes into the grass, and finally paid attention to the lacerations and bruises the Morrigan had given me. By the time they finally drove away, asking me politely to remain in town while they conducted their investigation, I felt good as new and fully recharged. Hal and I popped open a couple of Stellas, clinked bottlenecks, and toasted a good Bamboozle. Oberon got a few extra treats for his thespian activities, and when I inspected my DVD collection, I discovered that the female detective had actually alphabetized it for me. I got to feel good for about 3 whole minutes, and then my cell phone rang.
"Atticus, any chance you can get over here now?" Granuel said, Those two guys are back, and they say they're not leaving until they speak with you.
Chapter 16. Those two guys are already more annoying than the police, I said to Hal after I assured Granuel I'd be right there.
What two guys?
I quickly related to him all the details I knew, which were few, and that I needed assistance in gathering intelligence on them. Do you have a super sneaky way of sicking a private investigator on these guys so that it can't be traced back to you? I definitely don't want any member of the pack or friend of the pack to get involved. I'll pay for the investigator.
Absolutely,
he said as he watched me leap onto my bike.
Mind if I drop in to take a look at them in a couple of minutes? Pretend to be a customer?
Well, if you want.
You think I shouldn't?
It's just that I seriously have no idea what these guys are, except strange. I don't want to put you at risk. Hal snorted.
Whatever. I'll follow along in case you need my giant hairy muscles to throw them out.
He pressed the fob on his keys to make his car alarm chirp.
All right, I said, unwilling to argue about it.
I sent a mental farewell to Oberon as I pedaled away, pumping my legs as fast as they could go. I'd be there in less than 5 minutes. Plenty of time for me to think about what I was heading into. For the same two men to return twice in the same day, looking for me at my place of business, told me that they didn't know where I lived. And that was perplexing considering how much else they seemed to know about my whereabouts. And the urgency with which they wanted to see me indicated that they'd completely exploded my dumb college boy facade. The rabbi had already seemed to know it when they left the first time, but somehow between then and now they must have obtained proof of my magical mojo, which meant they probably realized how rare those books in my bookcase truly were. Whatever they wanted, I was already feeling like I wanted the opposite. It was 3 in the afternoon, that dead time of day, and no one was in the store besides Granuel, Rebecca, Father Gregory, and Rabbi Yosef. It was Perry's day off.
"Mr. O'Sullivan, we have been waiting,"
Father Gregory began, but I let him talk to the hand as I addressed my employees. "Both of you scoot for the rest of the day, on full pay, of course. And Granuel, don't forget to stop by Target before you go home. Sporting goods, you know," I said as a reminder. We needed to follow through on the alibi right away, since Geffert was pursuing it.
"Got it, Sensei."
Granuel winked at me, and she quickly gathered her things and jangled out the door, a worried-looking Rebecca close on her heels.
"What do you want?"
I asked the rabbi when the door had closed. He was clearly the boss and the badass of the two. The priest was a public relations man.
"We want to examine your rare books," he said in his clipped Russian accent.
I shook my head. "They're not for sale."
"For research purposes,"
Father Gregory interjected.
"What kind of research?"
"Magic and the occult."
"I'd suggest a library for that kind of thing." The rabbi was about to respond when his eyes shifted to the door. Hal walked in, and the rabbi's eyes bulged and his face twisted into a snarl. It seemed something malodorous was about to hit the fan, and I'd already had enough of that. I quickly confirmed that the rabbi was wearing natural fibers and crafted a binding between his jacket sleeves and his sides so that his arms would be frozen in place. The rabbi was fast, though. As I was speaking the binding, he whipped a silver throwing knife out of his jacket and shouted, "Die, wolf!" in Russian. The binding took effect as he reared back his arm to throw, and the result was that he abruptly sank the knife into the carpet by his foot, and Hal didn't die. Lots of snarling and spitting ensued, but I wasn't finished. I needed to talk to these guys without weapons being thrown, so I bound the priest in the same way I did the rabbi. After that, I doubled down and went to work on their legs, as they shrilly demanded that I desist. I bound the fabric of their pants from their knees to the tight weave of my store's carpet, which had the effect of dragging them abruptly to a kneeling position somewhat painfully. They let me hear all about it. Hal was understandably upset that a complete stranger had been ready to kill him on sight, but I really didn't want him to get more involved.
Gunnar was already steamed at me, and if I got Hal killed, he'd probably eat me like a Lunchable. I stepped between Hal and the two shouting, kneeling men and held up my hands. "I'm sorry, sir, but we're closed for the rest of the day. If you just come back tomorrow, I'm sure I'll be able to help you then." If I could make the men believe I didn't know Hal or what he was, so much the better. I nodded at Hal and tried to reassure him with my eyes that I had this. He nodded reluctantly back to me, his eyes a bit yellow, and left the shop without a word. No doubt there would be a quick investigation into these men now. As Father Gregory and Rabbi Yosef loudly insisted that I release them or face dire consequences, I turned to them and said, "You know, I think you guys might be the worst customers ever. Not only do you badger my employees and force me to interrupt an incredibly relaxing day to come deal with you, but you try to murder another customer when he walks through the door, and then complain when I prevent you from committing a capital crime." "Come on, Padre," I said to Father Gregory. "What would Jesus do?" Quivering impotently, and with flecks of spittle forming on his lips, he bellowed, "He'd rain fire down upon you for consorting with minions of hell." "Whoa, slow down there, Father. I think you've made several giant leaps of logic and faith, and I'm not following. First, I don't know any minions of hell. Second, I don't consort with anyone, because I'm not fond of that word. And third, have you ever actually talked to Jesus? Because I have, and he's not really a rain fire down upon bookstores kind of guy, just so you know. Now, who are you guys, really?"
"You have no idea who you're dealing with," the rabbi seethed.
"Well, yeah, hence the nature of my query." His beard seemed to be unusually active for a collection of facial hair. When a fully bearded man is talking, you expect a certain amount of twitching about the edges as his jaw moves around. But when the rabbi stopped talking, his personal topiary kept moving. "Hey, do you have some roaches living in your beard or what?" The movement stopped as soon as I mentioned it. I turned on my fairy specs, and it looked like a normal beard. The silver knife, though, thrust into the carpet, drew my attention. It was glowing with some extra juju, but, oddly enough, only on the hilt, not the blade itself. "Nice knife you got there, Rabbi," I said, squatting down to examine the juju a bit more closely. The red pattern it made connected 10 dots in a familiar sequence, then repeated as it wrapped around the hilt. It was the Kabbalistic Tree of Life.
"You may have it if you let us go," the voice said from the vicinity of the beard.
"Wow, no shit," I said. The rabbi didn't strike me as the negotiating type, so he must have hoped I'd just pick it up and say it was mine. The spell on the handle must do something nasty if anyone but the rabbi touched it.
"Yes, think of it as a gift."
My mom told me to beware of hairy men bearing gifts. Father Gregory said it his stuffy English best.
"It's supposed to be Greeks bearing gifts."
I paused to regard him coolly. He was an odd fellow, considering he was clearly a British native and at least partially successful in the Catholic hierarchy, yet also fluent in Russian and playing second violin to a Jewish guy who treated him like a trained show dog. Perhaps because of that, he demonstrated a desperate need to be right. Or righteous. Or both. My mom didn't know the Greeks existed, I told him. She was worried about cattle raiders coming out of what is now County Tipperary.
"Cattle raiders? But that was before St. Patrick's time. How old are you?"
"Don't you know already? You pretend to know everything else about me," I replied. "Shut up for a second while I check this out." I wondered if the magical wards in my shop could snuff this Kabbalistic enchantment without much fuss. I'd never had the opportunity to test them against this kind of magic before, because they were designed to protect the place against spells from the Fae and from Hell, as well as some of the more common forms of witchcraft. I'd run into a few Kabbalists here and there over the centuries, but they'd always been amiable sorts, and I'd never had cause to think of them as antagonists, until now.
This enchantment was still active because, essentially, it didn't meet the definition of magic according to my existing wards. I was near certain it was naughty, especially if this would-be killer rabbi wanted me to touch it, so I directed the attention of my standing wards to the knife hilt and expanded my definition of magic to include the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. The enchantment broke under the attack of my wards, and the red tracery of the juju faded. I flipped off my fairy specs and examined the hilt in normal vision. It was smooth black onyx inlaid with two sets of gold filigree characters. At the top, near the blade, were three Hebrew letters that spelled Netzach, or Victory, the seventh Sephirot in the Kabbalah. Underneath that, at the base of the hilt, was a curious logo that looked like a stylized capital P with a halo. "I'm confiscating this," I announced, plucking it out of the carpet with no ill effect, much to the rabbi's shock. "I accept no gift from you. When it comes to knives in my shop, I maintain a use-it-and-lose-it policy." I twirled it in front of the rabbi's face a couple of times to make sure he saw that his magic knife didn't hurt me. Then I walked calmly behind the counter of my tea station. "So, how about it, Father? Feel like making nice? If I was as evil as you seem to think I am, wouldn't I be sucking the marrow from your bones right now, or something colorful like that? Why don't I just brew us a cup of tea? I'll release you guys, and we'll just sit down and talk things over calmly."
"No dovratimu,"
the rabbi spat in Russian. Don't trust him. I still didn't want to give away the fact that I understood everything he said, but maybe the priest would respond to a general plea. "Look, Father," I said, "I don't know what this guy is saying, but if he's coaching you on manners or diplomacy, I think he's shown definitively by now that he doesn't know much about either one."
"His temper may be short," the priest admitted, "but he was right to attack the wolf."
"What wolf?"
"That man who entered the store was a werewolf. You cannot pretend you didn't know this."
I wondered how they knew so quickly Hal was a werewolf, but I suspected that challenging them on the righteousness of their actions would get me closer to information about who they were. "Well, so what if he was? He was in human form, and he wanted to buy a book. That's no reason to kill him."
"Werewolves must be slain on sight."
"Says who?" The rabbi was thrashing about in his jacket, trying to get his arms free by pulling the whole cloth of the fabric over his head or something. His hat fell off, and his face was flushed, and his beard began to move again. I could have bound the bottom of his coat to the top of his pants, and that would have stopped it, but his contortions were mildly entertaining, and I wanted to see what he would do if he worked himself free. I stayed behind my tea counter and made no threatening moves.
"Werewolves are abominations of nature. Nearly every religion acknowledges this."
"Ah, now I see. Do you guys also have a thing about vampires?"
"If by a thing you mean a predisposition to kill them, then yes, we do."
"How do you feel about witches?"
"We do not suffer them to live."
The priest flushed again, and I decided witches were a touchy subject with him. "Right. You couldn't possibly have said anything else. So what about me, then? What do you think you've been talking to?"
"You are a holy man. Like us."
That was a surprising answer. Didn't you just say a couple minutes ago that Jesus was going to rain fire down upon me?" He answered me in one of those condescending, this-is-for-your-own-good voices.
"There will be a reckoning for the time you have spent associating with infernal powers, but we recognize that you follow the old path of the druids."
My eyebrows shot up. They knew what I was after all. And where does it say that druids associate with infernal powers? Because we don't.
"It was druidic magic that opened a portal to hell in the Superstition Mountains," Father Gregory asserted, "and you were there."
"Bloody Angus Oak." "Yeah, and I killed most everything that came out of that portal. That was my only association with those powers, okay? I destroyed them."
And the demon at Skyline High School? That was the fallen angel Bazazel, also slain by yours truly. The priest paled even faster than he blushed, demonstrating remarkable facility in cutaneous blood flow and its constriction.
You slew a fallen angel?
He nearly whispered.
On a trois silni,
Rabbi Yosef growled from underneath his jacket. He is not that strong. Well, I'm strong enough to make you look like an idiot, I thought. He looked close to getting himself free. Yes, I did, Father. So, look, I'm willing to let you guys walk out the door with nothing lost but a knife and a little bit of dignity, but I don't want to see you again. You're not welcome here, and I'm never going to show you my books. I don't sell them to fanatics of any stripe. Let's just live and let live. When it comes to hell, we're on the same side anyway. Can we agree to that?
I cannot speak for everyone, Gregory said, casting a meaningful glance at the rabbi squirming in front of him. But for my part, I am satisfied.
The rabbi finally got one arm free of his jacket, and the other quickly followed. He immediately began to chant in Hebrew and trace a pattern in the air with his hands. I flipped on my fairy specs to watch. As he spoke and moved his fingers, tiny points of light in various colors hovered and then connected themselves in a gossamer threadwork. I saw already that it would be a spell based on the Kabbalistic tree of life, so I let him proceed. As soon as he was finished and tried to execute it, the shop's wards would recognize it and shut it down. The priest glanced at me nervously as his colleague chanted, wondering if I was going to do anything, but all he saw was my air of unconcern.
Ah!
The rabbi cried when he finished. He closed his eyes and tilted his head back, fists clenched and held out at 9 and 3, like he was driving a big rig, waiting for something to happen. Maybe he thought an angel would appear and kick my ass, or grant him strength, or give him a special brownie. After a couple of seconds of expectant heaving of the breast, he opened his eyes, turned his head, and saw me smirking at him. "Nice try, Rabbi Yosef." I released the binding on the priest's clothes and said, "You're free to go, Father Gregory. If you ever return, I will not be so polite or forgiving. This is your only warning."
"Understood,"
the priest said, clambering creakily to his feet. He shook out his arms and then took a few uncertain steps toward the door.
"Come on, Yosef," he said.
"Oh, the rabbi will join you outside in a few moments," I smiled. "We have something to discuss in private, if you wouldn't mind." Father Gregory checked with the rabbi to make sure that was okay with him. The beard nodded first, and then the rest of the head followed. The priest stepped out, and the bells above the door jangled noisily in the silence. "The father seems like a forgiving man," I said once we were alone, "but somehow I get the impression that you're the sort to carry around a grudge. Am I right, Rabbi Yosef?"
"If you have no traffic with hell or other abominations, then I will have no traffic with you,"
he grumbled through a jaw clenched in anger.
"But I have taken your measure, druid man. You traffic with these things all the time. You are unconcerned by werewolves. I am sure that bookcase is full of unholy works, and I would not be surprised to find you acquainted with witches and vampires. It will not be long before I am duty-bound to confront you, but it will be my job, not a grudge that brings the hammer down."
"Ah, it's your job that makes you act like such an ass-kitten. I get it now. You think you're one of the good guys and I'm one of the bad guys. That's okay. I'm used to it. But remember that I have your number, Rabbi. It's 10, and the height of my ambition for many years has been to be left alone. Please, do not disturb my peace again." I released the binding on his pant legs and gestured to the door. "You're free to leave now." He leapt to his feet and leered at me, then took his time about brushing off his knees and picking up his coat and hat, just to demonstrate that he wasn't scared of me at all. Still, he said nothing more, and his beard remained motionless as he pushed open the shop door violently
and exited into the late afternoon sun. I locked the door behind him and flipped the open sign to say closed. First, I gathered 3 pounds of yarrow, packaged it for Melina, and called a courier to come pick it up outside and deliver it as soon as possible. Then I turned off the shop lights and retreated to the Eastern Philosophy stacks, out of sight of the windows. I sat on the ground and crossed my legs underneath me, resting my hands on my knees. There, I spent a good 3 hours laboriously updating my personal wards to defend against Kabbalistic magic, something I never thought I'd need to worry about, and also reinforcing the quick protection I tied to my shop's interior wards and copying them into my exterior defenses. There were still many unanswered questions about those two, primarily regarding their shadowy organization and how they knew anything about my activities out here, but at least I had some solid leads now. They were religious zealots out to save the world from evil as they defined it. One of them had something living on his face, and I had a very interesting knife to give to the Tempe pack. I strongly suspected that the rabbi would be watching my store, either to follow me home or to attempt some sort of skullduggery, so I had plans to foil him. My shop, to all appearances, has only the single entrance. There is no back door, no fire exit, no other means of visible egress than the single glass door with a deadbolt on it. That would never satisfy a paranoid sort like me. I needed an escape route in case something big and nasty or official arrived. In a closet marked Employees Only, next to the bathroom, I had a steel-rung ladder bolted into the wall that led to a trap door in the roof. Said trap door couldn't be opened from the outside, in both practical and magical terms. I was the only one who could budge it. To give the rabbi the slip, I climbed the ladder with the silver knife between my teeth, pirate style, and crept out onto the roof, staying low in the early evening shadows. I cast camouflage on myself and shed my clothes, regretting the necessity of leaving my cell phone behind. I tied one end of a piece of string around my key ring and the other end around the hilt of the knife. That done, I bound my form to the shape of a great horned owl and firmly gripped the string in my talons. I then cast camouflage on it, the keys, and the knife and lifted off, silently, invisibly, into the Tempe night. I didn't fly straight home, but rather lit high up in the branches of a large eucalyptus tree near Mitchell Park. I spent a good quarter hour just looking around to see if anything had followed me, on both the mundane and the magical planes. How the rabbi could have possibly followed an invisible bird he didn't know to look for was beyond me, but paranoia was my standard operating procedure. Finally satisfied, I glided home and spiraled down into my backyard, where I released the binding and returned to my human form. Oberon was very happy to see me.
"Mr. Samarjian's back from the hospital," he said. "We can stick it to him again when he's feeling up to it. I hope he feels better soon."
I cooked dinner for us, then gave Hal a call from my home phone to suggest he pick up the silver knife to aid in the investigation of Father Gregory and Rabbi Yosef. I left it on the front porch for him, the blade carefully wrapped in oilskin for his protection, then immediately began to work on shielding my house from Kabbalists. Once I finished, hours later, I felt mentally drained from the exertions of the day, but I crashed gratefully on my bed and counted myself lucky that I didn't need to spend another night healing outside. Chapter 17. The Morrigan tried to wake me up gently this time, but she still managed to startle me into a waking nightmare. "Yeah, please tell me you're not horny," I begged, clutching the sheets and trying to hide behind a pillow.
"No,"
she replied, smirking, even though she was sitting naked on the edge of my bed, raven hair falling on alabaster skin.
"I have returned with the amulets."
4 black droplets of cold iron shifted with the percussive clack of rocks in the palm of her hand.
"Gavnu was quick."
"Ah, that's great." I lowered the pillow and sighed in relief. "Very good. Because I don't think I could take another day like yesterday." The Morgan laughed, genuinely amused, and it did not sound remotely malicious to me.
You look well, Shihan. You are completely recovered.
Physically, yes, but you left me in an awkward position with Briat, and you know you did. The goddess of death snorted.
I saw that she redecorated your kitchen.
She tried to kill me, Morrigan. She could have killed my hound.
I felt no danger for you at any time.
Her head shook slowly, and a tiny smile stretched across her face. Will you ever feel that danger again, now that you've agreed not to take me?
Oh, yes, I know I will, because I already have. It's coming.
It is? When?
Very soon, today or tomorrow, you battle with shadowy figures.
I was bemused. That kinda sounds like a horoscope. The Morgan laughed again. She was in an extraordinarily good mood.
I suggest you perform your own divination. Soon. But for now, I come bearing gifts. These three extra amulets are yours to dispose of as you wish. And there is a package of fresh sausage in the kitchen.
Thank you, Morgan, I said, taking the three amulets from her. They were teardrop-shaped, with a loop at the top to string on a necklace. Oberon's going to love the sausage. Shall I cook breakfast for us? Are you hungry?
Yes, I'm rather famished, and you make such excellent omelets.
Okay, I said, whipping off the bedspread and padding barefoot toward the kitchen. I had to go to the bathroom, but I was putting that off until I had the Morrigan settled. I didn't want a repeat of what happened the last time. Some watchdog you are, I told Oberon, who was sitting meekly by the refrigerator.
She scares me.
What? I've never seen her in such a good mood. I gave him an affectionate scratch under the chin and got out the makings for coffee.
That's what scares me. She's never even petted me, and now she's bringing me sausage? She wants to fatten me up for something terrible. I just know it.
I don't think that's it, buddy. I think she's happy because she feels she's beaten Briat somehow.
Well, it's disconcerting. Wait, discombobulating. I should get a snack for that. It's discombobulating because now I don't know what to expect, except a snack.
You must proceed on the expectation of good manners, both yours and hers. That is the essence of hospitality. The Morrigan walked into the kitchen and took a seat at the table.
Good morning, Oberon, she said with a smile.
Three kinds of cat shit, Atticus. She's talking to me.
So go over there and wag your tail. She won't hurt you, I promise. Oberon got to his feet, kept his head low, and wagged his tail slowly, half expecting to die.
Oh, you're actually coming to see me? I'm honored,
the Morrigan said. Oberon's tail wagged a bit faster.
This is quite a feather in my cap, to be acknowledged by the great druid's hound, she added.
Oberon bumped his snout under her arm, flopping her hand expertly onto the back of his neck. She immediately began to pet him with a series of massaging squeezes, chuckling softly as she did so.
She thinks petting me is an honor, Oberon said,
his tail wagging enthusiastically now.
This is an unexpected position to take for a goddess of slaughter, but I applaud her defiance of convention.
Breakfast was pleasant. The Morrigan asked for advice on what to do next with the amulet, and I advised her to wear it as a talisman for now and cast spells with it off and on to discover what difference there was. She had to discover a way to cast spells without any interference whatsoever from the iron. In the meantime, she should introduce herself to an iron elemental and give it a few fairies, asking nothing in return. Repeat as necessary, until the elemental asked if it could do anything for her. That might take years, I warned. It took me 3 years to get to that point, and I'm a friendly guy. Never betray a moment's impatience.
Where did you get the fairies to feed it?
Angus Ogg kept sending them after me.
Ha!
The Morrigan barked.